21, Donnie, Dr. Donnie. It's Dr. Donnie et al.
Yes, I have two others with me, so. Thank you, Commission Chair, members of the Commission, Director, Deputy Director. Again, my name is Donnie Martorello. I'm the Wolf Policy Lead for Washington Park Fish and Wildlife. I have with me Scott Becker, our Wolf Specialist, and Candace Bennett, our Wolf Conflict Specialist, who helped me out on today's presentation. And as it says there on the screen, this is our annual report for the last calendar year. So this is the 2015 annual report for implementation of the Wolf Conservation Management Plan. So real quickly, what we're going to cover today, a very comprehensive report. I'll start off and touch on the plan and the recovery objectives. I'll pass to Scott, who will talk about capture and monitoring of population trends, Candace, then with conflict management, and then I'll wrap up on those last four items there you see on the summary. So starting with the Wolf Conservation Management Plan, I know that everybody is aware and familiar of this. I would just like to make a couple points here. One is, of course, wolves are state-listed as endangered, and consistent with recovery plans for a state-listed species, the first goal that you see there, restoring a self-sustaining wolf population. The next two, managing wolf-livestock conflict and managing for a healthy prey base, recognizes that this species is a little bit unique compared to other state-listed species, and that part of managing for recovery also may include managing that includes the lethal take of wolves. And so the plan includes two items to address wolf-livestock conflict and concerns for prey populations that is a little bit unique to recovery plans that actually allows for a take of the species. And I know that folks are familiar with that, but I just wanted to call attention to that. And the last one, one other point, developing a public understanding of wolf management, promote coexistence. I'm going to spend some time talking about this one at the end of the presentation, but I just wanted to call out that in the past few years, when we've come to report our progress on the plan, this is one that we've highlighted each year, concern about a lack of progress on this goal. So I want to circle back to that towards the end. I want to cover a quick couple of definitions as pass the baton to Scott to talk about capture and monitoring. First one is the definition of a pack, which is two or more animals traveling together at winter. And then the definition of a successful breeding pair is a male and female that produce pups in April. At least two of those pups survive until the end of the calendar year. So that meets the definition of a successful breeding pair. Looking at the recovery objectives of our plan, again, the state is divided up into three recovery regions: Eastern Washington, North Cascades, and Southern Cascades and Northwest Coast. The recovery objectives are to initiate delisting when there are 15 successful breeding pair for three consecutive years, equally distributed amongst these three areas, four, four, and four, with the remainder being ones that could be anywhere in the state, or that same equitable distribution, but of 18 successful breeding pair for a single year. And the difference there is it just recognizes that the growth rates that we're observing for wolves in Washington, that we may actually reach the 18 successful breeding pair before we reach the three consecutive years with 15. And then I'll touch on some publications that we've recently completed, but wanted to call out one other item, and that is based on the trends that we're seeing so far in Washington that Scott will talk about, that we think we might be in the range of these recovery objectives by about 2021, plus or minus a year or two. Yes.
Is it really equally distributed, or?
Good question. The example with a 15 successful breeding pair, so that would be four in each recovery region, so that there's an equal number in each recovery region. And the balance could be anywhere in the state. And the last item before I pass it to Scott was just, a refresher here on the legal status. Again, the entire state is listed as state endangered. Under Federal Endangered Species Act, the western two-thirds of the state, it's federally listed as endangered, and the eastern third of the state, it's delisted, federally delisted. So it's under complete state management. With that, I will pass, change seats with Scott real quick.
All righty. Thank you for having me here. Good afternoon, Chairman Smith, members of the commission, and Director Unsworth. Scott Becker, as Donnie said, I'm the wolf specialist for the state of Washington. And today I'm just going to visit with you a little bit about wolf monitoring activities and the results of those activities that occurred in 2015. But first, I just wanted to talk about the public and the reports we received from them. The department obviously can't be everywhere all the time in the state of Washington, so we rely incredibly heavily on the public to provide reports to us of areas of potential new wolf activity to guide us to those areas in an attempt to potentially confirm wolves in new areas. And through public reports in 2015, we documented 4 new packs in the state this year. It wasn't necessarily department personnel going out and finding them. It was a variety of tools used that the public used to notify us, which greatly reduced our search areas in many of those areas and allowed us to actually confirm the presence of wolves in those areas. And because of the importance the public plays in the recovery of wolves in the state of Washington, the department provides a variety of ways for the public to reach out and contact us. And so we want to make sure they know exactly how to the multitude of ways that they can go about doing that. So in addition to hearing about reports via word of mouth and other online resources, the department created an online reporting tool so that if members of the public observe what they believe to be wolves or wolf sign, they can go to our department website, complete an online form, and the information from that form will then show up on this map. Then biologists in the state use that. Can click on that, find information about the reports, if there's any photos, anything attached to it at all, and potentially reach out to those people to gather more information about the sighting. On this map, the majority of the reports are unconfirmed, as we just don't have the manpower to go about and investigating every report that comes in. But what we typically do using this and the other tools that we have available is we look for clusters of reports in space and time. And so it'll put an idea in our head that there may be something going on in this area. We'll begin searching in that area. And as we continue to get more reports from that area, it really helps us focus our efforts to hopefully document something. And obviously, reports with photos or reports of multiple animals are some of the best reports that we can possibly get because it makes it a lot easier. And then we also know that it may or may not be just a lone wolf that's traveling through the area. If it's multiple animals, it may actually be something that's more likely to stick around for a little while. So we'll move on really quick to some capture and monitoring stuff. Unlike work in the bear world, wolf work doesn't end when wintertime starts. That's when it peaks for the most part. That's when our most intensive efforts do occur. So it's a big year-round effort. But I'll start really quickly, in the springtime. We set capture priorities in the spring to try and put ourselves in the best position for success. in order to capture wolves and fit them with radio collars. It's a very challenging endeavor, and so we use tools and techniques that always put ourselves in the best position for success so that we're hopefully in and out as quickly as possible. Our primary goal with capture efforts in the summertime is to try and get at least one collar in as many packs as we possibly can. And so that way, once wintertime rolls around and we bring a helicopter in to attempt capture efforts, we'll only focus and supplement collars in those packs that already have functional collars. And so we hope those animals will stay alive or the collars will continue to function up until wintertime. So we can get more collars out, so when the next summer rolls around, we can focus our efforts more on those packs that don't currently have radio collars. And by doing this, we're not constantly going back to the same pack over and over and over and constantly trying to get a collar in them. And we've got more and more out there on the landscape as well. But throughout the year also, we're constantly monitoring to document reproductive success, numbers, color combinations in packs, just everything we possibly can know about the wolves to provide as good estimates as possible as for what's actually out there on the landscape. So we'll talk really quick about winter capture efforts. Typically in the winter, we use aerial captures with a helicopter. Darting, we found, is the most effective method in this state. We did try net gunning our first year, but even with deep snow, there's just simply too much vegetation in this neck of the woods, and a corner will get hung up and a critter will slip right under it, and then you're left with a lot of choice words. But again, our focus, we don't use the helicopter or spotter plane to go search for uncollared packs, because we know the likelihood of us actually finding something that's uncollared is slim to none. And so that's why we just get in, use the collar to capture more wolves, and then move on. And so again, this will allow us to focus on uncollared packs once the summertime rolls around. So in the summertime, it's a very labor-intensive process, trapping is. There's a lot of groundwork that has to be done before you even lay a trap into the ground. You want to try and identify those high-use areas that wolves like to travel, and that's where you want to place your trap in the hopes that an animal's actually going to walk by and then potentially be interested in any scent or lure that you lay down and hopefully get curious enough to walk over and investigate it. And even with that, there's still no guarantee that you're going to catch anything. And if you do snap a trap, there's no guarantee it's even going to be there when you show up. More than likely it will be. But the best times to trap and the times of year that we focus on primarily is springtime is by far the best. And if you think about a wheel, the den sites or rendezvous sites are what we want to trap around. We don't trap right on top of them because then we have a higher probability of capturing pups. But what we want to do is lay traps around that den or rendezvous site. So if you think that den or rendezvous site is the hub of that wheel and the spokes is the roads or trails that all the other wolves are traveling to go get food, come back to the den, go get food, come back to the den. Those are the places we want to set traps because we know at some point a wolf is really likely to travel by that and again, hopefully be interested. In the middle of the summer, trapping is not the best. It's hot, so you have animal ethics you have to worry about, animal welfare. And the pups are getting older, so they're more mobile. And we don't want to capture pups because we can't fit pups with radio collars. And by catching a pup that you can't fit a radio collar on, you just train that animal, so you reduce the likelihood of ever capturing that animal again. But if opportunity presents itself and we feel like we do have a good opportunity to catch an adult, we will go ahead and lay traps in the ground in the middle of summer as well. but we typically will wait after spring, early summer. We'll typically wait until later summer once temperatures start cooling down a little bit. The pups are at that time are large enough to where they may be able to carry a collar at that point in time. And so we wouldn't worry so much about capturing a pup later in the year. But the pack is also more mobile at that time of year as well. So it's much harder to catch up to them, put that trap in the right spot to put yourself in the best position for success.
What's your mortality and morbidity from trapping?
We haven't lost a wolf due to trapping so far since wolves have been in the state of Washington. And we'll talk about mortalities a little later. We did have one capture-related mortality. It was due to aerial captures in the wintertime. But whenever you do capture efforts on animals, you know, you think of the general rule of thumb is you don't want capture-related mortality to go over 5%. If it's over 5% of your total, then you know you're doing something wrong and you have to change it to reduce that number. And so one animal out of, I think we've probably had 80, 85 total captures of wolves in the state of Washington. I think we're doing pretty good in that respect. So, before we get to Washington-specific information, I just wanted to look at the larger scale, the larger picture of wolves surrounding Washington and in the Northern Rockies themselves. This map right here represents known wolf packs, 313 of them throughout the Northern Rockies in 2014. And because wolves do not recognize jurisdictional boundaries, this map really highlights the cross-jurisdictional coordination and cooperation that's necessary to manage a species such as the wolf. We work very closely with BC, with Oregon, with Idaho, and even Montana and Wyoming. All the Northern Rockies states work very closely together to recover and manage the species as best they possibly can. The part of the reason we now have wolves in Washington is because of their innate ability to disperse long distances and find mates, set up a territory, and reproduce. The state of Washington, we've received dispersers that we know of from British Columbia, Idaho, Montana, and Oregon. And we've sent dispersers out of this state to every one of those states as well. And so there's constant intermixing among populations throughout the Northern Rockies. And before we even get into the nuts and bolts of the numbers that we've documented in 2015 this year, I first wanted to say that a lot of this information that you're about to see was not only collected by the department itself, much of the information. So I do want to acknowledge the efforts of other state, federal, and tribal biologists, as well as the public and private landowners that provide us access to their lands to actually conduct this work and do all of this stuff. It's really a team effort in the state of Washington. But this map right here depicts known pack territories in the state of Washington as of the end of 2015. The circles represent packs with unknown territories right now at the present time, and the polygons represent packs that we had a collar in and had sufficient enough data to actually define a territory for those packs. Of the 10 packs with known territories in 2015, that average territory size was about 349 square miles. And so you can see the challenges, especially in the summer, that we have to try and pick places to set traps and have a wolf step on a 9-inch pan and hope it, or a 2-inch pan, I mean, and hope that it's there when we show up the next morning. And we had good successes, which I'll talk about next. So in 2015 calendar year, we captured a total of 14 unique wolves 15 times. So basically it was one animal, wasn't too bright, stepped in a trap twice. Of those 14 unique animals, there were 9 adults, 2 yearlings, and 3 pups were captured, of which 11 of those animals were actually females and 3 were males. In 2015, we deployed 12 radio collars, and I know these numbers don't add up, so I'll explain really quick. 2 of the 3 pups that were captured during wintertime. It was February 2015, so those animals were large enough to carry collars at that point in time. Another pup was captured in the middle of summer. That animal was not large enough to wear a collar, so we just marked it and released it. In addition to those animals, as you're all probably aware, the Ruby Creek animal was captured during winter capture efforts, and that animal was subsequently placed in captivity for displaying habituated behavior around people. During 2015, we monitored a total of 22 unique radio-collared wolves from at least 13 packs that occurred at some point in the state of Washington, and that's including the Diamond Pack as well. So I think we did pretty good. During the summer, we had some collar failures prior to last winter, so we were only able to go after fewer packs than we were hoping for, but we were able to capture 5 individuals during winter. Summer capture efforts were good. We were able to capture 9 individuals in the summertime. Things went really well, at least in my opinion. So as of the end of 2015, due to radio collar failures, dispersals, mortalities, other factors, we were monitoring 11 collared wolves from 8 known packs at the end of the calendar year. And we did complete winter capture efforts where we went after 6 packs. We were successful in getting collars in 5 of those packs, so we know we're not going to have to worry too much about those packs once summer rolls around, and we can focus more on uncollared packs. So this table right here just represents statewide totals for the state of Washington right now. As we can see, the majority of wolves continue to inhabit the Eastern Washington recovery area. And right now, we don't have any known wolves or wolf packs in the Southern Cascades recovery area, although we are continuing to follow up on reports in that neck of the woods as well. And right now, as everyone's probably aware, our minimum count was 90 wolves, or at least 90 wolves, in 18 known packs that occurred in the state. And 8 of those packs were considered successful breeding pairs at the end of the year. And this table keeps getting bigger and bigger every year, so I'm not going to go through the details of this at all. This information is actually currently available online, and it will also be published in our annual report, which will be published with other Northern Rocky states by the Fish and Wildlife Service come April 1st. But one thing I do want to highlight is at the very bottom is the estimate of miscellaneous lone wolves that we have in the state. I know Dave Meach, he's one of the world authorities on wolves, estimated that 10 to 15% of the known winter population is composed of lone wolves. And so we incorporate that estimate into our minimum estimate as well. And so we provide a minimum estimate based on known packs on the landscape, and then we go ahead and multiply that minimum number by 0.125 to account for those lone and missing wolves that are on the landscape that we can't document. It's very challenging to document a single animal or even just a pair of animals running around at times as well. And so that number will account for those. And then in the North Cascades recovery area, instead of gaining a pack, we stayed stable. We documented a new pack with the assistance of reports from the public, and that's the Loop pack. And come the end of 2015, there was no evidence that the Wenatchee pack existed again, and so they were removed from the list. So this slide documents the trends in the minimum number of known wolves in the state of Washington. And 2015 estimates increased by 32% over 2014 estimates. Overall, excluding the first couple of years, the population in the state of Washington is growing at about 36% per year. And these growth rates are not out of the ordinary. There's what we expected for a recovering population. It's very similar to what other states experienced as wolves were recovering there as well. Trends in the number of successful breeding pairs is similar. We were stagnant for about 4 years. But this year was the first increase we had. We documented 8 successful breeding pairs. There were also 3 other packs in the state that we know reproduced and had at least one pup that survived in those packs. Even though this represents the number of breeding pairs, it doesn't necessarily represent the number of packs that actually had at least one pup that reproduced and had at least one pup that survived to the end of the year. And these trends as well are not any, it's what is expected in a recovering population. And this figure here depicts trends in the number of packs that we're observing in the state. These are, again, minimum known packs that we have, and there has been a steady increase in the number of packs in the state of Washington. I did want to highlight very briefly camera survey work that we're the department and partners are conducting as well. And that information will be available in the annual report, but for what we know of, we had at least 207 cameras out in the field for a total of almost 15,000 camera nights. About 7,000 of those camera nights were in the eastern recovery area, and then there was about 3,500 camera nights in both North Cascades and Southern Cascades recovery area. So even though we haven't documented persistent wolf use in the Southern Cascades, we are still attempting to document packs down there. And just because we have not detected wolves down there does not necessarily mean there aren't wolves down there. It just means they have avoided detection up till this point in time. But we will catch up to them at some point. And this figure depicts known wolf mortalities in the state of Washington compared to the minimum known population that we have. And so these numbers aren't anywhere out of the ordinary either and are very similar to trends observed in other states. I'll talk very briefly about the 7 known mortalities we had in the state of Washington. 3 of those mortalities were legal harvest on the Spokane Indian Reservation. One mortality was an unknown cause. Another one was a vehicle collision on I-90 outside of North Bend. We did have one self-defense mortality. And then we also had the one capture-related mortality as well. And with that, I will hand it over to Candace.
Good afternoon, Chairman Smith, Commission members, Director and Deputy Director. Donnie and Becker said, my name is Candace Bennett, and I am a wildlife conflict specialist in Eastern Washington. Some of the things that I'll cover with you very briefly today include the work that conflict specialists and other staff members do with livestock producers, as well as I'll briefly cover some of the deprivation events that occurred in 2015, and then finally cover a few slides on compensation for livestock losses. So as a conflict specialist, one of the things that we do is work with livestock producers to reduce or minimize livestock depredations due to wolves. We do this by one-on-one meetings, predominantly with the producer. And during that time, one of the most important things that we're doing is we're meeting with those producers to understand as best we can their operation. So talking about the history of that operation, is it a generational operation, current concerns that they may have, and then what they want that operation to look like in the future. And so we're doing that by talking about preventative, non-lethal tools, what are they doing now, what do they need help with, what would they like more information with, as well as we're working, and I'll explain the checklist here in a few slides, on what that checklist looks like for preventative, non-lethal tools. Another aspect, when applicable, we are working with these producers on the cost share, or it's a legal binding contract that I'll talk a little more about. One of the other things that we do as conflict specialists is work with them if there is a livestock depredation, walking them through the compensation claim packet, and there's direct reimbursement and direct reimbursement, and then finally with lethal removals as well. So here's a map of Washington. You can see there's names all across the state of different conflict specialists, supervisors, technicians that work as conflict specialists. And then you can also see overlaid are the blue polygons of wolf pack territories. It's important to note that as conflict specialists, we're working with not only livestock producers, but we're also working with private landowners with ag damage from deer and elk, turkeys, and so we're all working on different species, not just wolves. In northeastern Washington, though, for example, Jay Shepherd, most of the work he does do is surrounded around wolves. So here's a list of some of the preventative tools that have been implemented and some of the tools that we work with producers on. I want to note that for most of the producers that we do work with, they're already doing some of these things. So all we're doing is just helping them enhance some of these tools, tweaking them a little bit, and, you know, maybe providing some information on tools that they didn't know were available or newly available. So just to kind of call out a few of the things that we do work on, so range riders, that's a human presence thing, and each operation when we're working with livestock producers is different, and the things that they're comfortable with or the operation needs is different. And that can be different from producer to producer, location to location, and then sometimes even year to year those can change. Some of the other things that we've worked on is carcass disposal. So, for example, Sherman Creek Wildlife Area now has a compost facility. We're working on one in the Blues, it sounds like, which is fantastic to hear. It's in the works right now. Done. Okay. Yeah, so we're trying to expand those locations as well for compost facilities. These are facilities where livestock producers can bring their dead livestock and they can be composted away from the operation so that it's not an attractant to really any type of predator, including wolves. Here down in the bottom right-hand corner, you can kind of see this is some of those preventative tools at work. It's a livestock guardian dog. With an exclusion, so the flagry type of fencing with the domestic sheep on the other side of that. Okay, there we go. So this is the front page of the checklist. So each of the producers that we work with, these are those preventative, non-lethal tools that they've either done in the past, they're currently doing, or things that they'd like to try in the future. And there's really five main categories for these. Sanitation, which that includes that carcass disposal and removal, different types of animal husbandry or operational types of things, so time of turnout, where they're lambing and calving, for example, removal of sick and injured livestock. The next is that human presence, so this would include the range riders, for example, or even just simply, if you're on a dairy, instead of the times that you're milking the cows, you're going out at, you know, later in the evening as well. So just human presence in general. There's also hazing, which this is direct contact or direct interaction with wolves, for example. So spotlighting, pyrotechnics, just outlining what those things would look like. And then finally, just exclusions, so shed lambing, you know, how are they separating the livestock from other predators? So this is that contract piece. It's a damage prevention cooperative agreement. It's a mouthful. We just say DPCALs. And this is a binding contract that outlines some of these preventative tools, but it's also outlines the cost share that's associated for those types of operational adjustments that they're making. You can see here in the figure, it's a little hard to see. You have the years across the bottom, starting in 2013, and then moving to projections up to 2017. It was a little slow uptake, but based on what we're seeing, and there's more conflict specialists on the ground now working with producers, that's going to increase. And so these contracts are year-to-year, and they're funding dependent. So here's just a map of northeastern Washington. You can see the wolf pack territories outlined, and then you see little call-outs with different numbers on them. So the first two numbers is the year. And then you can also see there's some grazing allotments as well outlined in a darker color. And so it's important to note you see that some only have one number associated with it, and some you can see multiple years. So it's really dependent on the operation and the needs of that producer and wolf activity as well. So one of the things that we did do in 2015 is everyone from the field level staff, so conflict specialist, wolf biologist, all the way to Olympia, is we wanted to do a risk assessment readiness assessment of what the upcoming grazing year was going to look like in June of 2015. And so some of the things, this is a long list of some of the things that we discussed. But for example, we discussed, you know, past depredations for packs, for each specific pack. We talked about what we knew about grazing that was happening within those pack territories. And based on all of this information, we put together wolf livestock conflict deterrence plans. And these plans we put on our webpage for each pack to look at. And it's, you know, has a map, and I'll show you one right here. So this is for Dirty Shirt. For example, and you can see at the very bottom, this is a screenshot of our webpage, and so you can see that wolf livestock conflict deterrence plans. And so switching gears just a little bit now that this is up here, so Dirty Shirt was one of the locations where we did have depredations in 2015. Dirty Shirt territory is found in Stevens County, Ponderay County border, just east of Chihuahua, if you're familiar with that area. And once these depredations occurred, the second thing you can see just above the deterrence plans is event chronologies. These event chronologies were updated on a weekly basis and posted on our webpage as well for people to look at on what was going on the ground. In the Dirty Shirt territory last year, we had four different depredation events, all of them involving cattle, three adults, and one calf. During that time, that was about mid-July or early July to mid-July, we increased human presence. We also had additional range riders in the area for several weeks after that. So moving on to the second of three events that I'll talk about are depredation locations was the Tianaway. This is in central Washington near Cle Elum. There were two depredation events for this pack in 2015, both of them confirmed involving cattle. And finally, so the Huckleberry pack split into two different packs. So it says Huckleberry, but the location of where this happened was predominantly in the Stranger pack, but the same area, Stevens County, just north of the Spokane Indian Reservation. This involved a domestic or a guardian dog that was guarding a small band of sheep near the producer's resident. This happened in about mid-August, and shortly after this depredation event, the dog did make it. The livestock producer did move the sheep closer to their home place, and then subsequently after that moved them to their winter grazing location. So how do we get to lethal removal of wolves? So I'm sure you're all familiar with the flow chart. This flow chart was established in 2013. It was put together by RCWs, the WAC, the Wolf Conservation and Management Plan, as well as some advice from the Wolf Advisory Group at the time. Just to go as quickly as possible through it, depredations, once you've reached, we do them by events. And so, for example, like the Huckleberry had one event, so that would help you outline. It's not representative of the number of animals, it's just the time frame that it happened. Was it one event, two events? So after two events, it's possible that it can be forwarded to the director for decision for lethal removal, but possibly four. And so those are moved. Currently, what we're doing right now is we are working with the Wolf Advisory Group to review this flow chart and get stakeholder input, and hopefully have something rolled out by this grazing season for June. So this is just to summarize the location. So there was four different depredation locations in 2015. So the Tianaway, that included the two cattle. And you can see how Huckleberry, right there, as you're moving eastward. It's the Stranger location is where the guardian dog depredation event happened. And then just east of there is Dirty Shirt, and north of there is a Smackout. Yes, sir.
So how many cattle were killed this past year?
So I have a figure that'll show that. So it'll be the next one after this. So this reflects what Scott had 2007 to 2015. And you can see in the light-colored bars are the number of packs in Washington. The dark-colored bars indicate the number of packs that have depredated. And so you can, it's a little hard to see, but in 2007, 2012, 2013, and then to current year. So here's to answer your question. Can you see that okay? Okay. So this figure illustrates in the lighter-colored bars the number of domestic animals depredated on, and then the black indicates the number of wolves that were removed via department authorization. And so you can see those removals happening in 2012 and 2014. And so last year you can see that the seven cattle and then the one dog, guardian dog. So moving into compensation, compensation is outlined by the Wolf Conservation and Management Plan, and it's broken into two different categories based on the depredation investigation, so whether it was a confirmed or a probable wolf depredation, and then also compensation is broken out by the size of the location where the depredation occurred, so less than 100 acres or more than 100 acres. And the table below it is an example of some of those compensation claims. So you can see that it's the claim date, and then you can see the animals involved. The claim amount is what the producer writes originally in the claim paperwork, and then we have a third-party appraiser review the claim, and that's what you see as in that fourth column, and then the fifth column indicates the payment and date for those. One of the things for Washington, we're one of the only ones to do this additional indirect losses. We did put an indirect loss board together to look at. It's a five-member board to look at greater than normal losses, unknown losses, open rates, for example. And we do have two pending reviews. Those will be started to review next week. And it's important to note that the dates of when these were originally put in, so both of these claims, were 2014 and 2015. And so, it's something that we're very concerned about, and we'd like to move through these to work through these claims. And I'm very pleased to say that that'll start next week. And so just to kind of summarize back some of the information that Scott had brought up, so you have, this is a table that looks at the summary of wolf population, but with the addition on the far right column of percentage of packs that depredate, and what you see here is the 10 to approximately 20% of packs depredating, and that's what we've seen in other states before us, and so we're falling right within that range.
Thank you, Scott and Candace. This is the first time that we've had some field staff here, and I recognized immediately I can't do as good a job as they do. It's great to have folks here that actually are the boots on the ground, the working knowledge and the depth that they cover compared to what I've done in the past, so thank you very much. Moving to the next section of the presentation, just to touch on some highlights on wolf-ungulate interactions. I want to first just recognize that, as I talked about in the second slide, that our plan does have that uniqueness that wolves are different than other listed species, and it does allow for the department to consider the removal of wolves to address concerns to ungulate populations through predation. And there's more information, of course, on that in the plan. And what it really identifies is that it calls out that if there's a at-risk ungulate populations and wolf depredation is found to be the limiting factor, then we have that to consider lethal control of wolves to address that. And the important part here is the term at-risk, really, what does that mean? And that it's the primary limiting factor, that there's evidence that wolves are actually the limiting factor for that concern with an ungulate population. And so in terms of what does that at-risk, what's that definition of at-risk? It could be any federal or state listed ungulate population. So one example might be woodland caribou in this case. It could also be an ungulate population that falls 25% below its population objective for two consecutive years. And we could find that particular population objective perhaps in the game management plan or an elk herd plan and then track or whether we're below that for a period of time at what level. And then recognizing that we may not have that level of data for every ungulate species, it also identifies that, or it could be that the harvest decrease is 25% below a 10-year average rate for two consecutive years. And so here's three bends, if you will, of what at-risk means. And then, of course, as I mentioned, that potentially if wolves are a limiting factor, then queuing that up for some sort of management action. So we haven't got to that point yet, but I wanted to give you an update on a couple key documents that are help defining that space for us. The first one is in the 2015 calendar year, we put together an assessment of ungulate harvest data and population trend data in Washington. We made a couple presentations of that, I believe, to the Fish and Wildlife Commission and Game Management Advisory Council. And that information, again, is on our website. And this is a qualitative assessment. I just want to provide a couple examples of the kind of information that's in there. So this is just one example out of that long presentation so folks can start seeing the data that we're tracking, in this case, the harvest data. So in this one, this is buck harvest for some core GMUs that overlap with wolves. And you can see we're talking about the northeastern corner of the state, and this is already out of date. There are more packs in that area of the state. And these highlighted GMUs are the next graph that I'm showing, GMUs 101 through 121, where we've plotted out the buck harvest, estimated buck harvest for each of those years, and then with some annotation, in this case, identifying 2009 as a buck harvest significantly declined after two hard winters in 07 and 08, called out the years there that overlap with known wolf packs from 2009 through 2014. This presentation is almost a year old now. And then another call out that in 2004, or 2011, the year that instituted the four-point buck restriction and the harvest strategies in two GMUs. So this kind of information is available for many of the GMUs around the state. In that the same area, here's the same kind of information for bull harvest in those core areas. And without making any assessment to any cause or an effect or those kinds of things, just making that clinical data available to the public. And then here's the last example of moose harvest in those same core areas overlapping with when wolves arrived on the scene. So in addition to that, which was the 2015 calendar year, we also completed the first phase of our moose research project, and that progress report is also available online. And then I think as Game Division Manager Mick Cope talked about earlier, we have a couple things coming up. One is the ungulate assessment and the predator-prey investigations, which will help frame this issue in the wolf context. Switching gears now to stakeholder engagement. So one of the things that I did this year was we put a lot of information online and wanted to take a look at Is that being viewed, and what's being viewed, and is it a good resource for folks? And so what you're seeing here is on the left-hand side is each of our main pages on our Wolf landing page. In the graph, you can see the page views that we're seeing over the course of a year. And so just giving you a sense of what folks are looking at and how many. Here's 30,000 page views on the Wolf packs that Candace talked about. A little under 20,000 under general Wolf information and on down the line of that information. So this gives us an idea about where are people going to get their information. What do they want? Where are they looking? What do they want information about? But it also gives us a sense of, okay, is there key information that we can put on the pack page or the general page or the reporting page to make sure it's getting the visibility if it's something where we're concerned about? We also are continuing with our more standard types of outreach efforts. We do a number of meetings around the state, too many to enumerate. It could be a small one-on-one meeting. It could be a meeting with producers in the Blue Mountains, meeting with you all, meeting with county commissioners, just a number of opportunities like that that we have to engage with the public and talk about Wolf information and getting the latest information to the public. We did a media tour this last year in the Tianaway area. We're hoping to do another media tour coming this spring. Already talked about the one-on-one meetings. We also attend meetings with the Forest Service where they invite us along with their permittee meetings with the allotment holders, or allotment meetings with permittees. We have a series of both internal and external trainings that we try to offer. I'll be talking about some of those later on. And then, of course, getting information out via news releases and other printed materials. One of the things also that we've become to rely on more and more in 2015, which seems to be going good, is that use of that emails that we do to the Wolf Advisory Group and interested parties. And that interested parties is a very long list of people and media and county commissioners and elected officials, et cetera, et cetera. And it's a way that we can get that information that's occurring in real time out to the public and so they're aware. Just real quickly to touch a little bit on research, we could go on this one for a while, but I just wanted to touch on it. The top one is a manuscript that we recently completed and was published, looking at the monitoring and wolf populations and modeling the progression of recovery. As I mentioned on the second slide right now we're steadily progressing as we expected from the modeling perspective that suggests that we might see us around our recovery objectives by 2021, plus or minus a year or two. Some work that's gone on at the University of Washington and the Colville Confederate Tribes on wolf colonization and mule deer and white-tailed dynamics. And then there are a number of graduate students working at Washington State University that are finishing the first phase of their projects there, looking at wolf-livestock interactions. My understanding is that there are theses being prepared right now and publications, and so the first phase of that is coming up on completion. There's also an ongoing research project with USDA Wildlife Services looking at additional breeds of guard dogs, larger guardian dogs for livestock. And Washington has some of those experimental dogs as well as other places in the Rocky Mountain area. So we're a part of that project. And then I just recently found out this last week that a wolf economy project at UW our thesis has recently been completed and will be circulating soon. So a lot of ongoing work going on, starting to see some of the publications and completions of those projects. And then I'm just going to quickly touch on a few other items here. Just wanted to call back to attention to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, their proposal for federal delisting of gray wolves in the lower 48 in 2013. We have not seen any additional information or progress on that. So I just wanted to bring that up and tell folks that we haven't seen any more movement on that. We are working locally with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and Wildlife Services on coordination strategy. We've developed now a coordination strategy and are now of kind of who has what role in what corner of the state and with the complexity of listing statuses in the state and are finalizing that right now. Folks are probably also aware that of a recent litigation and ruling, federal ruling, that prohibits USDA Wildlife Services from participating in lethal control of wolves in Washington State. So they are continuing in other capacities right now. So for capturing, monitoring, and just helping us radio collar wolves, helping us do investigations of wolf livestock depredations, helping with deploy preventative tools. They continue in all that capacity, but right now they are not able to participate in any lethal control. We had a couple interagency wolf committee meetings in 2015, so working with other land, other agencies and land managers. And I'm going to touch on this one a moment in a slide as well, some changes there. Had a number of interactions with the Wolf Advisor Group. Going to dig in a little bit more on that one. And recall in 2015, we had an assessment done, People and Wolves in Washington, which really dove into the conflict of wolf management and our situation here in Washington. That document is complete and is available on our website. And as you know, knowing the situation, it really identified that on that last goal that I talked about, that we had not seen progress in the last few years on coexistence of wolves and a public understanding of wolf management, it really is tied to some deep-rooted conflict of our stakeholders and our communities in Washington. That report really identified that, hey, there's some deeper stuff here that we'd like to address. And so we brought on a consultant to help us start a process called conflict transformation. I just wanted to touch on that a little bit more. So the director for that we brought on that's working with us on a consulting basis now is Francine Madden. I think all of you have met Francine and know her. And I think you've seen this before. Well, you have seen this before, but I wanted to touch on it for the public that hasn't seen it. And I can't describe this to Francine, but it's pretty key in getting the big picture of what I'm talking about when I say deep-rooted conflict. So what you see here in this triangle is levels of conflict, and the first one is dispute, next one is underlying conflict, and the last one is identity-based, deep-rooted conflict, where we believe we are in wolf conflict in Washington. And the way to think about this is imagine a car accident where two folks have a fender bender, and they get out of their cars, and they go through that normal process of exchanging numbers and exchanging insurance, and that's a dispute level where they've never met. They have this incident that happened. There's a dispute. They work through that process. It's done, completed, and we go on. Now imagine that same car wreck where the people get out of their cars and it's a couple that recently went through a nasty divorce. And they have to exchange the same information, but they have some history here of conflict. And so in that case, that's underlining conflict. Now imagine that same car wreck, but in this case, it's two folks that get out and have never met each other. But imagine it's a country that just went through a civil war. That civil war just ended. These folks get out of their cars and recognize that they were on opposite sides of that civil war. That's the deep-rooted conflict. And so that's the situation that we believe we have in Washington, where we're talking about wolves, but there are some deep-rooted issues in this that go farther back, that we have to address those issues before we can really move forward on wolves. So this slide is kind of washed out. My favorite part is not here, and that is the Wolf Advisor Group that's sitting here in a U that you can't see. Maybe you can on your printouts. But so we've started this conflict transformation process, which really starts, and you've heard this before, go slow to go fast. It starts by getting to know the people, humanizing the situation, so that you can build a relationship that's resilient enough to start talking about wolves and some of the bigger issues. And so that's the process we've been going through in 2015. We have an expanded Wolf Advisor Group that includes 18 members. It includes livestock producers, environmentalists, and hunters. Those folks represent 13 organizations. Some of them represent themselves in those capacities, but it does represent 13 organizations. They've had 5 meetings to date, now not just 2015, to date. They've had 5 conference calls where they talked a little more on issues, particular issues, and we're making all that available to the public. And they've participated in 1 field trip. I just touched on that it would say go slow to go fast process that is really built on relationships. So you got to start with a resilient relationship before you can get to the heavier lifting, if you will. And so you see that here in the topics that they've addressed. They spent a number of meetings getting to know each other at a different level. They started working on an individual producer plan. That means that they started at something smaller and said, what is the right balancing point, if you will, between preventative measures and management action? They took that on an individual producer plan level to start framing it a little bit and understanding it, and then they moved on from that. They provided recommendations to the agency on the damage prevention agreements that Candace talked about. And now we're getting to the go fast part, where at the last Wolf Advisory Group meeting this month, and another one coming up in May, where they're talking about the lethal control protocol and a path for lethal control, kind of revising what Candace talked about in our flow chart, if you will, with a better stakeholder process, better relationships, so in the end, those folks are able to provide more meaningful contributions to the agency. So what I would report here at this stage is I'm going to go back to the goal that I talked about, that unlike in prior years, I believe we're seeing significant and good positive progress on that last goal. I see stakeholders working together like I haven't seen before. And, you know, I've been with the agency for a number of years, and it's very encouraging and neat to see those folks around the table being able to tackle some tough issues and provide meaningful input. So bringing us around the home stretch now, each year we provide you an estimate of, or not an estimate, the numbers that our Wolf expenditures are cost for the previous year. The best way for us to capture this, we live on a fiscal year, so this is not necessarily 2015, but from July 1st of 2014 to June 30th of 2015. I'm not going to go through these numbers. You have the information. I'll just point out that the total here is very similar to last fiscal year. And you'll see if you start lumping numbers here that the two biggest components in terms of costs, expenditures, are capturing, monitoring, and trying to minimize conflict, whether that's preventative or lethal. But those are the two ones. Addressing the capture monitoring is really addressing that goal of how close or how are we doing on reaching our recovery objectives, and then our work to minimize conflict between wolves and livestock. Those are the two big pieces of pie and the cost that you see reflected here. Last slide, looking ahead to some things that are on the horizon. We're working on, and I got some new ones to add to this, we're working on some opportunities to meet with livestock producers here in the last half of April, provide some training on preventative measures, circle back to them on some things we're hoping for during the legislative session that's wrapping up right now in the budget. But we have some, looks like at least five meetings around the state with our conflict specialists and wolf biologists, with specifically with livestock producers, to talk about those kinds of items. Going to continue, of course, on this path with WAG and stakeholders. I wanted to stress one item here, though. We're spending a lot of time working with WAG, but recognizing it's not just those 18 folks. We're also looking for opportunities to work with communities, folks outside of WAG, so that as this process unfolds with WAG, that we're also reaching out to those rural communities and those other folks, so there's not a distance between, you know, in this conflict transformation process, that the entire Washington is moving down a path. Next one, third here, is an expansion of the Interagency Wolf Committee. We'll be adding elected officials to that, meaning county commissioners. So we're trying to work with county commissioners that in areas that have wolves, add them to that community, that government-to-government relationship. And then Candace mentioned we recognize the shortcomings of the paying compensation and the timeline piece of that. We have expectations on ourselves to shorten that so that folks are paid within a reasonable amount of time for compensation. So that's one of the things on our list. And then the last one that's not on this list is something we're looking for between now and federal turnout June 1st, is going out and visiting with county commissioners, talking about the work we're doing with WAG on the lethal control protocol, call, getting their input, and also perhaps some listening stations around the state. Again, recognizing the importance of not just working with WAG, but working with communities also. That's all we have. Ready Thank for any you. Questions? Yes.
Thanks, Chair. Donnie, where do you see you're going intergovernmental? And you mentioned county commissioners. What are you foreseeing that being?
So we the Interagency Wolf Committee is in a committee that's already exists, and we've had four or five meetings, I think, so far. And it's largely U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Forest Service, DOT, tribes. And it was, and so we meet to just talk about everything wolf-related and the coordination between us. And so it might be with DOT, you know, getting them information on what a wolf looks like for road kills and those kinds of things, and with the Forest Service on grazing plans, whatever it might be. There was just a recognition that, that county commissioners need to be at that table as well.
Oh, okay.
So it's a, should have had them before, didn't, bring them to the table now.
Sure, Grable.
Donnie, thank you. I had a question from Jack Fields about what's the procedure to replace, say, a member of the WAG committee that has quit or gone away. And just, I don't know if you have an answer for me right now, but I guess we have a hole that needs to be filled since Dave DeShell left.
Correct. I'm glad you brought it up. That's a good point. Wanted to talk about that. That's correct. So we've had a vacancy. We've had one member of the of WAG, the Wolf Advisor Group, that, that is now not on the group. We provided some time there to kind of see, you know, there was some, that individual was going through some changes and didn't want to do a red light, green light, but give that individual some time to think about whether they could be on the group or not. It's now time to look for a replacement. We've had a few folks, including Jack Fields, provide nominations. And what we'd like to do, and so this is an idea now, what we'd like to do is get that pool of nominations, grab a couple folks from the department and some current members on the Wolf Advisory Group to interview those folks. And that is just a recognition that those relationships are really important. And so we want to bring somebody in that fills that need. And so a livestock producer from northeastern Washington, but also that there's that, through that interview process, that looks like it's a relationship that can quickly fill into the seat and with a good, strong connection. So we're wanting to get started on that right away.
Thank you. Any other comments? Before we bring this to a close, Representative Short or Commissioner McCart, did you want to say a word or two?
Thank you very much, Commission.
Thank you. Good job. I am wolf wise now.
Good afternoon. Thanks, committee chair and members of the committee. A couple of things I'd like to point out. I was here just interested in the update on the report, and one of the things that I'd like to point to the commission members, there were fewer depredations last year, not because the wolves weren't present in these areas. You know, our cattlemen did at great expense to their operations, moved their livestock around and out of the area, and in some cases back onto private property. And so, I began getting concerned when I started hearing from folks within the department and around the area that, this is working. And what I want to let you know is it is, but it's still a significant cost to my producers. There was mention about some of the folks and our dairy operations about doing nighttime activities. Well, that's on top of a 16, 17 hour day, you know, in a normal operation. And so while my folks are committed to being a part of the solution, I just want you folks to continue to remember that a lot of this is at significant cost. And, we haven't really gotten to that point about what we do when a producer has to, as they indicated on Dashiell's, move from August pasture or pasture, their summer pasture in August, to their winter pasture, you know, in August. So there's significant adjustments that these folks have made. And so as we look to, you know, the less numbers, I think the thing I still have to point to is the importance of having lethal protocols and using them. Because at some point you will have to do that. So would just like to make that mention, so there's some, some information around that numeric number. So, but appreciate everything that's going on, like the work of the WAG, hoping come to decisions, on lethal protocols and guidance that the department feels they can use and that it's timely. We're coming up on grazing season, you know, this year. And so, you know, as you would expect, my folks are still very, you know, very nervous about this. So really appreciate your time today, and thanks for listening.
Thank you for your attendance. And,
you bet.
And your effort.
I want to thank Representative Short for your leadership, your sound, reasoned, common-sensible, and very calm. You're bringing a presence to the commission that's extremely helpful and constructive. Thank you.
We just, and I would appreciate that, and thank you. We all are working together. It's just we do need to get some results, so trying to just keep pressing on, so I appreciate the commission on that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Brad?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Sure.
Thank you, Chair. And again, Shelley, I would like to thank you very much. The one bright spot in this whole thing that has had me concerned for a couple years but seems to hopefully be getting resolved is Francine Madden. And I know that you were an integral part of getting that to happen. Yeah, there's a lot to be worked through, but no, I'm very optimistic on that. So thank you.
You bet. You bet. Thanks.
Commissioner, did you have any other words? Yeah, well, your words were words of wisdom. So that brings us to a conclusion of item number 22, and thank you all. I think the tone is positive. I think the concerns are real, but I think the willingness to address the concerns is also real. So we will move into item number